Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it is Thursday, January 28th, 2021. And this is a special meeting of the town council in the council chambers to discuss a joint work session with the Historic Preservation Commission to discuss the design standards for the Curie Beach Downtown Historic District. Okay. The first item on the agenda is the design standards themselves.
Shall I go ahead and get started?
Sorry?
Okay, shall I start that discussion?
Please.
Okay, great. Again, yeah, thank you for having this joint session. I appreciate the opportunity to kind of work through what we've done. Just as a very, very quick introduction, I'll turn it over to Mr. Eldridge to really bring us into discussion. And as everybody remembers, this started about a year ago now, where we were asked by the council, members of the council, to go ahead and try to figure out some way that we can get a little bit better handle on development that would be in the downtown area, with the idea that you look at the current land use plan, there's a lot of statements regarding the desire to keep family orientation. The survey that was done maybe about 10 years ago had a number of items where people wanted to maintain the architectural standards and develop architectural standards for downtown. Having done this in several other states where it's fairly simple to do that, you simply set up an architectural review committee and find an area that you can review and you can go ahead and do that. We found out very quickly in the state of North Carolina that you can't do that, that we're restricted by statute, that we cannot really look at architectural or examine architectural aspects in commercial buildings, with the single exception is that if you're in historic district. And if you're in a historic district, then you can, in fact, have some regulations regarding the architectural sort of things that go into a particular area. Looking at the historic definition in state statutes, that term is very broad. It's certainly much broader than the word historic. In fact, I personally think it's probably a bad term to call it a historic district because it is so broad. So once we figured out that, we had to go through some very specific processes in terms of developing a historic district proposal. Mr. Eldridge, the P&Z attorney at the time, or historic district or preservation commission attorney at the time, was very specific and assisted us greatly in terms of making sure that we followed all the steps that needed to be followed according to statute to get us to this particular point. So this is where we are, and just a couple of very, very quick comments about the design guidelines, because that's really what we're here talking about. When looking at the design guidelines, I know personally I've probably looked at about 50 or 60 design guidelines for different historic districts throughout the state of North Carolina. They extend from very, very complicated, for example, if you look at the historic district, one of the historic districts in downtown, one in Wilmington, it's probably 70 pages long. It's very, very detailed in terms of materials and types of trees, you know, all these type of things that would be in there. You look at some other ones, and Raleigh actually is a pretty good example. Raleigh has very, very flexible, maybe two or three pages in length, very, very flexible in terms of saying, just, you know, make sure it's compatible, so maybe some specific guidelines and so forth. Obviously, the less specific you get, the more you're into an area of interpretation, okay, that somebody has to interpret this. These type of guidelines, but we felt that given the town of Curie Beach, and this has always been the motivation of both P&Z and now the Historic Preservation Commission, is that when we suggest and bring a ordinance or suggest an ordinance to the town council, we've always brought it with the idea that keep it simple, keep it very, very simple, two pages. When you look at the lighting ordinance that we just brought, for example, again, we could have done 30 pages, but I think we brought a two-page or one-page lighting ordinance. So there is a matter of interpretation. We did have several meetings. We've had actually open meetings now for a year. We did have a special meeting in early January that was designed to get public input. And as I think I mentioned in the last council meeting, that we only had one person who was a resident on Settlers Lane call in. She was in favor of it, but just thought that we needed more of a preamble, you know, part to it, which we did add, by the way. We also have John's comments, Mr. Bass's comments that we went through point by point during the last meeting. All the HPC members also had recommendations. So what you have now is a revised set of design guidelines versus what you were presented when I passed it around maybe about 3 weeks ago or four weeks ago.
That's your original copy.
One last thing I want to kind of mention to remind everybody is because that there is a degree of interpretation when you have fairly short type of design guidelines, that the current HPC is a temporary HPC. That was appointed by the town council specifically to get us to this particular point. There is nothing that requires that the HPC be constituted by the P&Z members in the future. You could designate yourself as the HPC, I think. I'd have to check with Mr. Eldridge about that. Certainly my suggestion, and this would be my personal suggestion, is that the future HPC that would interpret the guidelines would be made up of maybe a couple members of the P&Z, a couple members of the town council, and maybe several members from the community that are in the B1 district. So, you know, realize that, you know, I think the interpretation component is an important element to it, but the future HPC, if you implement this particular district, can certainly be a different makeup than what you have now. I don't think there was any intention when we started this, if you go back to the minutes for the town council, that that the current HPC would be the makeup of the future HPC once this is implemented. So, you know, we've, I think, done our job. We were at this particular point. We're presenting it to the town council, hopefully. But, you know, wanted to have this joint session to kind of clear up anything. And hopefully you've had a chance to kind of listen to our discussions that we had at the beginning of January. It was about a three-hour session. We dealt with a lot of issues. I think a lot of the issues that would probably come out of this. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Eldridge.
Excuse me. Oh, okay, I thought the door was locked. Somebody was trying to get in. Sorry. Go ahead. Welcome, Councillor.
I'm going to go through some housekeeping chores first. This is also a special meeting of PZC, Planning and Zoning Commission, so I want the minutes to reflect that. Member Ken Richardson, something came up, a personal matter that he had to deal with, so we would ask that he be excused from this meeting. Somebody could make that motion.
P&Z has to do another.
I'll make the motion to excuse Mr. Richardson from this meeting.
Okay.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Craig ended with a reflection on the current...
Excuse me, sir. Don't you need to excuse Mr. Garceau as well?
I don't know if he has already resigned or not.
I'm just asking, so...
In the event that Mr. Garceau has not officially...
Is he on the phone?
He said he would call in.
He's not on yet.
He's not on.
Let's have a motion to excuse him then.
I'll make a motion to excuse Mr. Garceau.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. The establishment of the HPC, which Chairman Galbraith closed on in his comments, is something that I don't want to reflect on today. That's in the future. Right now, you've got an HPC that is fully authorized and endowed with all the powers, duties, and obligations under the statute. And if this project goes forward, sure, we can change the composition of that. But I want to stress that it would simply be changing the composition. The body itself exists fully under the statute. But and one more housekeeping chore. On your agenda packets, the design standards here are version one. All my comments are going to be from the workshop materials. Design standards one is in there in your packet so that you can see the changes, which are not track changes. But nonetheless, so you can compare version two, which is in the workshop materials, to the design standards on your list, which is version one. Version one is the set of standards that Mr. Batson made some extensive comments about, which really allowed us to go ahead and simplify the process and produce what I call version two. I don't think it's labeled as that, but you'll see. Now, some introductions and some of it, I won't use the word redundant. instance, but Chairman Galbraith touched on some of these things, but they bear repeating in certain respects. And I'll introduce it from some subjective comments. I've been with the town for 5 or 6 years, but all I ever knew was Dow Avenue and Town Hall, and of course, the Fort Fisher trailers. I'm really not that familiar with the town, but I've constantly heard small town, family-friendly, beach town. It wasn't until HPC got deep into the designation report that I finally understood what that meant. And you have to understand, I've lived in coastal towns, Virginia Beach, Massachusetts, Roanoke Island, Outer Banks, all my life. And I've seen those towns change over the decades where they've lost a lot of the charm that you all still have. In the process of producing the designation report, which is also included in your packages for reference and background information, I walked around the historic, the D1 district, and I was struck. I understood exactly what everybody has been talking about. And it was fascinating to me, which, and it's recreated in page 1 and 2 of what's on the screen right now, the beginning of the workshop material. It is remarkable how 15 years ago, the land use plan set forth goals and policies that are almost verbatim what we're trying to accomplish through this historic district process at the present time. I really do wish that you would take a minute or two just to read each of those extracts from the land use plan, because it really tells it like it is, and it's what we've been struggling with for a year. What is also remarkable is that in the 15 years that has passed since then, given all the developmental pressures that any coastal community will experience, it's remarkable that you still have all of this here so that you can do something about preserving the character of this nature. You're very fortunate, but I don't think I'm remiss by saying if we don't do something, the changes will occur over time. And what are those changes? Those changes are as follows. B1 is a by right district for commercial use, and also with a lot of legally non-conforming residential use, which under the code, that residential use can be extended up to a certain point. But beyond that, there are absolutely no controls. So you may end up with something in the B1 district that detracts from the current atmosphere or ambiance or whatever you want to call it about the B1 district, that detracts from its small town family-friendly atmosphere. And the example that I like to use, and personally it's not a criticism because I kind of like the structure, but just try to imagine the all-glass house on Fort Fisher Boulevard plunked down in the middle of B1 and ask yourselves whether that's consistent and harmonious with the small town family-friendly feeling that B1 gives off. That segues into something else that Chairman Goldberg mentioned, and which I was reluctant to agree with over time, but I have come to agree with it now. Do you mind if I shut this door?
No, be my guest.
There's a lot of noise back there. We are proceeding under statutes that in the general statutes are simply named Historic Preservation Commission, Historic District. But Chairman Galbraith is absolutely right. It's more of a preservation goal that we've got here. And in my in working up on all these documents, I agree with him that in many other jurisdictions, the word historic has been dropped completely. We initially reached a compromise on that with the current name, which is the Downtown Fury Beach. Fury Beach Downtown Preservation and Historic District. The Historic Preservation Commission label has to remain, that's statutory, but the name of the district can vary. And I think it's interesting to focus on that word historic because I think it lends itself to some misapprehension and potential misunderstanding of what we're trying to do here. We're not trying to tell anybody what to do with the property or how to use the property or what that property has to look like up to a certain point. And in that, and we don't, we have historic buildings, but not in the sense that Beaufort or Morehead City or Old Wilmington does. So one of the things that you all may want to consider, which I think there's absolutely no impediment with doing it, if you want, you could drop the word historic altogether for the district, not for the commission, and simply call it the Curie Beach Downtown Preservation District. That actually is a better fit and may avoid some misunderstandings on the part of all of us. Deciding making boards, advisory boards, staff, and particularly property owners. So I'd ask you to keep that in mind. And I mention that because if you look at the historic district statutes, which under 160D are in the 940 section, they are the most interesting statutes I've dealt with in 30 years because they're not black and white, they're fuzzy and gray. They talk about the, they give authority for municipalities to establish historic districts based on the atmosphere, the ambiance, the feeling, the association, and the character of that district, and they don't provide definitions of those words. And I think that that, in many instances, is a good thing because it allows us to apply that to the B1 district, but it's also, it has the potential to mislead because it's hard to define those terms. It's hard to define what is the ambiance of B1, what's the character of B1, what is the feeling of B1, what's the association of B1. For our purposes, and I've lived with this for a year, for our purposes, to me it boils down to two things. The family-friendly, small-town atmosphere. But here's the crux of the matter. You've got something there right now that gives you that feeling, gives you that small-town, family-friendly atmosphere. And the name of the game that we're trying to accomplish is to preserve that character. We don't need to define ambiance or atmosphere or character or feeling. We can say, look, right now, and even 15 years ago, in 8 different instances in the land use plan, we know that the public and that the town is committed to preserving the small town family-friendly atmosphere. That means, in essence, that you're trying to preserve the character that's there right now, and there's nothing in the statutes of North Carolina that allow you to add to that. And what we're trying to do is preserve that. So I would suggest to you that you keep one thing in mind as we walk through the design standards and the text amendments. And that is this. You can go down the rabbit hole of preserving preservation in Old Town Wilmington Historic District, but really what you're trying to do is to make sure that the changes that occur in the B1 district or the historic district are consistent and harmonious with what you've got there right now. For example, that all-glass house in the middle of the B1 district would not necessarily, in my opinion, which is simply my opinion, come across as consistent and harmonious. But I want to mention that to you, and really that's the bulk of the changes that were made to the design standards was to go with the goal or the standard of whatever changes occur need to be consistent and harmonious with what's there right now. And that is a function that you, town council, do every time you consider in a quasi-judicial proceeding a special use permit application. Because in a special use permit application, one of the things that has to be shown by the applicant through the presentation of evidence is that the proposed special use is consistent and harmonious with the district and where it, in which it wants to go in. So...
Can I interrupt just real quickly there, in case there's anybody online? Special use permits, by definition, manage the use, not the architectural design. So, you know, that it's not an effective way to do what we're proposing here with special use permits, because it's a use management issue.
No, but let me quickly comment, though. What my point is that the process for approving work in the historic district is no different in some respects than the process of council weighing in on a special use permit, in that they need to determine, without the benefit of specific guidelines and standards, whether the proposed use, you're right on that score, is consistent and harmonious. And that's the same function that is utilized for exterior features in a COA process. So rather, my point is this. When an applicant comes looking for approval for a change in the historic district, it's not a question of, as Chairman Galbraith pointed out in his presentation, it's not a question of being told what he can and cannot do, what materials he can and cannot use, what paint colors he can and cannot use, what his architectural detail can or cannot be. In our case, the question is, are the proposed changes consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood? When town council considers special use permits and has to resolve the issue of consistent and harmonious with, they do it without guidelines. In this case, we have guidelines. We have two sets of guidelines, design standards, which have been boiled down and are very broad and open, and also review criteria, which we'll see when we get to the proposed text amendments. And again, let me reiterate, we've got two things going on here. By statute, the historic district is created by text amendments to Chapter 15. But part of those text amendments also require the publication of the design standards to guide the process. And what is that process? And this is another point that can be confusing. We've lived with it for a year. There is a bit of a learning curve, as we can testify to, for that year. There was some getting used to the statutory language and some of the process and procedures. But one of the things that there's two things to keep in mind. One is, nothing, assume for a moment that the historic district is established, that you all go with the idea a month or two from now, you adopt the text amendments and the historic district is there. It's important to remember that the only thing that the historic district regulations regulate are changes to exterior features. So anybody doing routine maintenance, anybody doing repair work that does not involve a change, minor or major, to the exterior features is completely unaffected by these regulations. It's only a change to the exterior features that trigger these regulations. And we went one step further than in that. If there is a change to an exterior feature, sure, you have to get the approval process, which I'll talk about in a second. But we've carved out a major, let me use a different word, we've carved out a significant exception by creating a category of minor work. Minor work is simply changes to exterior features which are not that significant, and we provide a fairly lengthy list of examples. But that's an important distinction, because minor changes, or minor work as we call it, can be handled by staff and administratively approved. We don't have to go through the whole process of a quasi-judicial hearing, which major changes does go through to obtain a certificate of appropriateness from HDC. And we're not burdening, we take the position that staff is not going to be burdened with that obligation, because if staff cannot determine whether the changes are significant, minor, or major, the provisions allow the building inspector to pass that matter up to HPC, and HPC can consider it as a commission as a whole. So we're not burdening staff. If it's clear on its face, then it's a rubber stamp procedure. You get the piece of paper, you can do it. Again, if there are no changes to the exterior features, you can do it. Otherwise, you come before HPC and seek a certificate of appropriateness. So, unless there's any questions at this point, I suggest that we walk through real quickly the design standards and walk through the text amendments, and then start the commission and council can start talking about these things.
He emphasized a very important thing too, that this is just dealing with exterior. In no way we're looking at interior. I know that was one of the big issues. We did have several B1 district property owners come very early in the process, and were concerned that we were trying to regulate what they were doing on the interior of their particular properties. We're not doing anything on the interior, purely exterior.
You'll find when we get...
Were they not also concerned about the exterior regulation?
At the very beginning, the primary concern that we heard from the folks that came to our commission was interior. We had nobody express any major concerns about changes or regulations regarding the exterior. We haven't heard anybody come to any of the meetings that have expressed concern about exterior regulations. They were concerned, and there's only about two or three people very early on, that were concerned about, well, this won't affect my ability to do what I want to do on inside my particular property.
I think you'll see when we get to the text amendments in particular, that there are probably six provisions that derive completely from statutory black and white language that are very reassuring to council, to the town, and to property owners about the limited role establishing is, the limited impact that this historic district will have. Mayor, you wanted to ask a question?
Yeah, I was listening to what you had said, Craig, and what you had said, Counselor. And what you're saying is that you've addressed many of the things that John has brought up, and I think some of the questions that I had asked. And I generally always ask this question, because when you're arguing for something, you usually hit the good points. As an owner, if you were an owner, what part of this would be troublesome to you?
Yeah, I can answer that. I own a number of different properties, and several of my properties are in historic districts, not in this city or in Wilmington, but in other historic districts. And probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I had about 10 different properties, of which one was a commercial building, a three-story commercial building in a historic district, and I also had a residential property in a historic district. There's no question that I made much more investment and put many more investment and more dollars into my historic district properties than I did in the other properties, because I know that the district, in terms of having regulation, reduces the risk of what in economics are called negative externalities, the fact that somebody else, my neighbor, would do something that would damage my property values. And so I certainly, speaking of somebody who has had a property in historic districts, and I still have one of those properties right now, there's no question that historic district properties are, it reduces the risk, it's beneficial. That's what all the research shows too. I have several friends that own properties in the historic district in downtown Wilmington, and they say exactly the same thing. I've talked to them about this too, is they make tremendous investments in their properties because it is in fact in the historic district. Now the concern basically is that, well, if somebody wants to do whatever they want to do, if they want to bring a glass modern-looking building and put it down there, right down in the downtown area, this would certainly regulate their ability to do that. Would it regulate their ability to do something that I would call maximizes their benefit out of that property? No, it doesn't. But it does provide some regulations. Essentially, you know, what we're trying to do is, I think, make sure that things are harmonious in the character of what was talked about in land use plan and so forth and what's currently down there. Non-harmonious things would probably be very modernistic type of things or expressionistic type of buildings. In addition, something that would be harmonious would be a McDonald's, for example, or something like that that would be a drive-through type of thing. But other than that, there's really not a lot that regulates this. And I, in my personal opinion, from my own personal experience, is that that adds value and will actually provide assurance not only to people within the B1 district, but also surrounding the B1 district that will promote their investment and development.
Mayor, in one sense, I don't have a dog in this fight. I do what the policy ends up being. Policy thus far is to produce these, what we bring into you today. But yeah, there's some bias because I've had some time put into it. But to answer your question, through those filters, I don't find anything about the design standards or the text amendments establishing the district to be burdensome at all. But what I'll suggest to you is we're going to walk through each of those provisions because they're not that extensive, they're not that comprehensive, they're easy to digest. And I think my hope is that when we get to the end, that you'll be able to answer that question for yourself very clearly.
Okay.
And see that it is not important. But
okay,
before we begin that process, let me say one thing. You, which I should have included in my opening remarks, you have a small town, family-friendly district. We all know that. We all know the charm or the feeling, the association, the ambiance, the character, whatever you want to call it, of the B1 district. It's there. I saw it for myself. It will change over time. That's a given. Every community I've ever lived in along the coast has changed over time. I think you're fortunate that it hasn't changed over time. The question is, if you want to preserve that special characteristics of that district, can you do so under the North Carolina statutes? And as Chairman Goldberg pointed out in his presentation, the opportunities to do that under the general statutes of North Carolina are extremely limited. There's a statutory prohibition against regulating exterior features on residential structures. So with that in mind, there is no way that you can uniformly regulate the appearance of exterior features in the B1 district because of that statutory prohibition. Point two, we considered whether we could get to the goal of set forth in the land use plan 15 years ago of preserving that character through a special use process. But as Chairman Garber pointed out, that only regulates use, not exterior appearance. Literally, the only way in North Carolina that you can regulate exterior features short of a subdivision where the covenants require the same is through the historic preservation process with guidelines establishing what the intent is and authority to proceed with projects that have been approved under those guidelines through a COA process. That's the only way. So if you don't have that, you're running the risk that a by right B1 commercial use or legally non-conforming residential use, they can do right now whatever they want to do, literally whatever they want to do to the exterior appearances of those commercial and residential uses in the district. If you don't control it, that's what you're left with.
Well, that's true of the entire community, unless you're in an HOA. So that's not just the B1 district. My house, I could do exactly what you're talking about.
That's correct, but I thought the focus was on the B1 district.
No, Well, it is for this conversation, but let's be clear. That issue is not a B1 issue. That's an issue of all of the people in the town like me that don't want other people telling me how my property should be, that look at the statutes as they're written and as they were when I bought my property 30 years, more than 30 years ago now. I don't want to say how long ago, but long enough ago that was the understanding when I bought my house in 1986. And that was the understanding when my grandfather bought his house in 1951. And that's been the understanding of every property owner in Curie Beach until the North End's added property communities that had HOAs. And everyone that bought that property in their HOA signed up and into the deal of the covenants and restrictions when they purchased their property.
I understand all that.
Okay, I just want to make sure we're clear about that. It's not just a B1 issue that you're talking about. That's an issue of all of the town with the exception of the HOAs.
That's correct. But the point being, the reason I'm here presenting these standards is that for over a year, with council's guidance and directions, we have focused on preserving the quality of B1. And I'm simply mentioning that there's no way to regulate that quality outside of a COA process.
I appreciate that.
That's the only point I'm making.
And if I can jump in too, that's understood in every community that has a historic district. I can't think of a single historic district where the historic district covers the whole town. There's about 700 historic districts in the state of North Carolina. This is not a unique thing that we're doing. Wilmington has 5 historic districts. Raleigh has 7 historic districts. It doesn't cover the whole town. It covers specific things that the council is trying to preserve the character. And that's why you put boundaries around historic districts. And we were told by the town council to put the boundaries as defined by the B1 district. We actually had a conversation very early on. Did you want to extend it? Did you want to narrow it down within the B1 district, let's say for 1 or 2 blocks and so forth? And the council directed us to limit our discussion to the B1.
I understand.
We could have gone broader. We could have gone narrower. Mm-hmm. But certainly understood that everybody outside, whether it's an HOA process or a historic district, can do whatever they want to do with the property as long as it fits within some.
Can I get a comment?
Sure.
Mr. Mayor, you asked what kind of burden it might put on property owners. And I do struggle with one section of this, and we can talk about it more fully when we get to it. But the administrative approval for minor repairs, I feel like it puts an undue burden on the homeowner if they want to replace siding or replace their shingles on their roof. They have to come to the building inspector to apply to be able to do that if they're doing it within this district. And it says that they're exempt from the full COA process. But what I would rather see is it say that they're exempt from this, as long as they are only doing this list of things that are exempt and can be approved administratively, I think they should just be allowed. So the
that's where I'm at in my presentation, but before we get into the nuts and bolts of it,
so
the question that I have is how do you monitor that? How do you monitor compliance? How do you know what's the check and balance? You don't want to be in the position of allowing somebody to do that and they do it contrary to what the regulation is, and then you have to tell them to tear it down and do it right.
So,
whereas the administrative process, which personally I think is pretty non-intrusive, is just a check and balance to make sure that what is committed is done without conflict down the line.
I mean, not to oversimplify that, but I would think it sounds like it's an extension to the regular permit process, where you would go to John and say, I have these things I wish to do. Do I need a permit? The only difference there is that you have to tell them precisely what you're going to do, and then is it by interpretation fit the design standard?
Well, why don't we get into it so we see.
Yeah, we should.
Before you, real quickly, this is what we all struggle with. This is what we've been struggling with for the last 2 or 3 months. We've had 5 members on the HPC. We've had a lot of conversations. We've changed the wording from what I think you were originally presented, you know, with some of the concerns about trying to modify the burden on a property owner for doing something that would, you know, like again, changing tiles or changing those things. So we've taken and reduced the burden on a number of things based upon votes of the overall Manhattan Commission. But yeah, I mean, you do see, you know, discussions about exactly the sort of thing that that you're talking about in terms of where you want to put the approval process. But yeah, I think the best thing is maybe walk through with what we have right now.
My on your screen right now, 3.1 COAs, that's just the basic requirement under the historic district statutes for, again, for major changes to exterior features. And we will see more about that COA process for major work as we get into these standards and text amendments. But since we've been just referencing the minor work exception, that starts on 3.2. And I'll just highlight some of the provisions. Minor work on exterior features is defined in the text amendment, Chapter 15, zoning, which we'll look at in a minute. May be administratively approved by the town's building inspector without a COA hearing. Now, the rest of those two paragraphs do have some specific timelines, but they're only in there for purposes of due process and appeal. If somebody comes in saying this is minor work and the building inspector says, no, I don't think it is, you've got to go to the HPC. Well, that applicant needs some due process rights. And basically, we've established some timelines for that property owner to make the appeal. To make the appeal and when that appeal is heard by HPC. So really, it just shifts the burden over to HPC. But the timelines are simply for the due process consideration. They don't have anything to do with the approval of changes. Turning the page, Mandy.
So, just to start with timing, so this could take up to 2 months if they appeal. And it looks like it could take longer than that because I don't know who the clerk is, but it's 10 days after the clerk received the appeal. So, am I reading that right?
A dated letter, well, let's just read them.
Yep, okay.
A dated letter approving or denying the request shall be issued by the building inspector to the applicant generally within 2 business days.
So there's 2 days.
Appeals of administrative decisions for minor work shall be made in writing to the HPC within 10 days after the date of the letter. The appeal should be considered and acted upon by HPC in a special or regular meeting no earlier than 10 calendar days. I don't know of any other appeal provisions under the land and development regulations that are as fast-tracked as these. This really has everything occurring, theoretically, in less than 30 days. But I think the heart of the matter is what does the minor work consist of? And we begin in a lengthy list of examples on the next page. And if you could, I never know what scroll.
Yeah, so you left out the 30 days after the appeal hearing.
I think that's for the decision.
That's right. Well, the decision, you can't start the work until after the decision.
Well, I don't have any problem. Whatever you all want to do.
No, I just want to make sure I understand the proposal. I sat out and timelined it last night, getting ready for this meeting. I want to make sure I'm right, so I understand.
Yes, I agree that that's how you can read the last sentence.
The first couple things are actually under the control of the applicant. You know, we're saying that has to be within a certain day. They can make it within 1 day.
I said they did theirs in 1 day, and I added all the other time.
1 day.
That's right.
We could certainly recommend that if there is an appeal, that it has to be dealt with by the HPC within a shorter period of time.
And we can shorten the decision.
You can shorten that.
I'm just asking questions so I fully understand.
Well, you read that correctly, and that certainly can be revised. Mandy, can you get more four on that? There you go. That's the list of minor work that can be administratively approved. And I take Ms. Zielinski's point well. The question is, how would you changing the exterior features, this doesn't even apply. So for example, if you're going to put up, and having said that, it looks to me like some of these things can still come back out. For example, under I, alteration, restoration. So you're, under I, you're altering, restoring, or erecting shutters and blinds. Seems to me that could come out because there aren't any changes if it's going to, first of all, if we take out alteration altogether. But if the shutters or blinds are, if there's not going to be any changes to the exterior appearance
page
of
seven.
The shutters and blinds, I don't think that ought to be on the list. But I think you get the gist of what the list suggests. This is minor. It is more than some changes, but insignificant or less substantial to the exterior features. And this is the type of work that could be administrated or approved. 3.3, we start to get into the COA procedures. It's an application and a fee. The application should include the information needed to show compliance with, to show that the proposed changes, in this case major changes, are consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood. And we'll see more about that process in the text amendments. And you have page 5, please. Next page.
So, just for this one on timing now, this is the non-minor, right?
That's correct.
So, minimum of 30 days before your meeting. So if you are close in, that could be as bad as 60 days just to get it on your docket, or 59 days to be actually
correct. Same thing with Board of Adjustments, though, right?
I know. But that's not to get work done on your property. For Board of Adjustments, this is to do work at your property. So that's what I'm asking. So it's 59 days, and then in here, I'm not seeing how long it takes for them to, I guess they rule at the meeting. Is that what this means?
Well, it's 30 days before the date of the next HPC meeting, so it's on the agenda for that meeting.
Right, so if you're 29 days before the next one, you can't get on until the next one, so that's 59 days.
Unless HPC has a special meeting, correct?
That, I'm just trying to get the timing so I understand all the timings, right?
Yeah, certainly.
And I'm sorry I wasn't at your meeting to call in, but I was out of town at work. So I did listen to it, and I didn't hear the timings. If they were specified, I didn't catch them when I listened to your discussions. I'm not saying that you didn't cover it there, but I did not get that from listening in the car.
When we discussed it, we wanted to make sure that everything could be done within 30 days. We did have that conversation.
Okay.
You know, in terms of
but then I didn't understand
things,
it.
How long things would take. So as we look at this and walk through this, you know, you might find something that could be changed, for example.
Okay.
You know,
right now, I just want to understand.
Could be is they could meet special meetings. They could meet only when, kind of like a Board of Adjustments, only when certain things happen that could trigger some sort of meeting. There's different mechanisms setting this up. But I think everybody on the HPC, as well as Mr. Eldridge, would feel that we want to move as quickly as possible
okay.
whenever an application
okay.
is made.
I just, and that's what it says, right?
To be honest with you, the 30 days plugged in there is, you know, I've been with towns and cities since 2000, and it's just a submittal deadline that is very commonplace. I didn't even give any thought to it. I just plugged in the
okay.
one. I mean, the whole idea, is, of course, is to allow staff time to digest the application present a report to HPC, which will consider that along with the applicant's materials and the applicant's presentation at the hearing. If that work can be done in 10 days, that's fine. Like I said, I just plugged in 30 because that was a knee jerk. Page 5 is where we get into the general standards. Again, sub 4.1A, the erection, alteration, restoration, or relocation of any exterior feature should have the look and aesthetic of the 1940s, say one thing right away. I have suggested in this presentation that we're taking the approach that proposed changes to exterior features in order to preserve the small town family-friendly atmosphere of the district needs to be harmonious and consistent with that B1 neighborhood. If the designation report, which was really a legal document that, first of all, it's required by statute, but one of the benefits we got from the state when we turned that into the Department of Cultural Resources, I think it was to do that, again, required by statute. One of the lessons we learned is that the designation report is really your insurance or your safety net in case you face a legal challenge. And that's why I've recommended in your spare time, if you haven't done so, to look at the designation report, because from a cultural standpoint, from a historical standpoint, from the historical standpoint of the development of Curie Beach, including the Civil War, but also with an architectural narrative, the designation report provides much more meat to the bone, so to speak, of what that 1940s, 1970s aesthetic look is. For purposes of the text amendments and the design standards, we simply rely more on being consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood that you've got there right now. Some of the standards flesh that out a little bit, like the general standards. One of the things that is suggested to be not utilized in the preservation district is modern or expressionistic designs. Exterior features should be consistent and harmonious with other exterior features in the district in terms of scale and design. Inappropriate modernist or expressionistic architectural designs include but are not limited to construction consisting of or containing predominant glass elements, glossy materials, round window features, exposed steel elements, broad roofs, or exaggerated overhangs. And then the next paragraph defines modernistic and expressionistic architectural design. But again, the house on Fort Fisher Boulevard is the example that comes to my mind. B, colors on exterior features should be consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood. You can run into many, many design standards or guidelines that specify your colors, and we try to avoid that. I think if you just go through the neighborhood and look at the colors, that's a pretty broad palette that can be utilized. Try to avoid pattern color designs and franchise operation branding painting design. Building facades simple, not consistent with multiple sizes. Roofs should be uniform. Roof features, uneven roofs, oversized roofs should be avoided. Design features, including windows and doors, should be normal scale, no large scale windows or doors. And again, we're not bringing this to you as a finished product. This is a joint work session. This is what we've come up with so far.
Just very quickly, we had a discussion, I believe, that some members of the HPC mentioned that, well, would this also apply to the windows that would be facing the ocean? Because somebody might want to build, you know, a much broader picture window, basically, over facing the ocean. And that's something that, you know, we ended up leaving this in, but, you know, something that could be put in, except that if it's facing the ocean, you could have a bigger window or something like that.
So can I ask another question? I'm going to ask a lot of dumb questions. I apologize. So does the Curie Beach Park fit into 1940s to 1970s? The town built down?
No, I would say
so. That's 1970s architecture?
I would say in general for a pavilion, yes. I don't think that would be... What we're trying to do, I think, is when you walk around the B1 district right now, the vast majority of the architecture there is that kind of either 1940s to 1970s feel, or if it's somewhat more modern, in terms of construction, it still has that kind of facade type of look. And again, example would be downtown Wilmington. There are much newer buildings down there, but the historic district wants it to look like in that case, maybe an 1870 to like 1910 types of building. So when you go down Market Street and you will go for that two-block area right there and go down Water Street, some of those buildings are much more modern in construction, but they still have the look and the feel of an older type of building.
The designation report certainly focuses on the 40s and 70s theme, but the design standards and the text amendments focus more on the small town, family-friendly beach town. It could be that the pavilion could be consistent with the beach town theme, but here's what it comes down to. Somebody wants to build a house facing the ocean in the district with a big picture window. They bring it for a COA. The only thing HPC has to decide is whether that design or those materials are consistent with the look and feel of the neighborhood surrounding that particular property. That's what it comes down to. It's not that you can't use that window. You can't use a big window. If that big window is there and it fits and it's fine and it integrates into the neighborhood, then the HPC could find that it is consistent and issue the COA. But if that window is, I don't know, it's hard to hypothecate about something that's not in front of you, but if it's purple glass and surrounded by chrome and shiny brass and with a green overhang, a glittering green overhang, then I think you would determine that's not consistent. That's what it comes down to.
Just something very quick. There have been some changes. These were originally called guidelines, and they are guidelines. They're not set in stone. There's guidelines to provide the Historic Preservation Commission, if they're presented with an application, whether to approve the certificate of appropriateness or not. They are guidelines, and they were originally called guidelines. I believe with the current, as of January 1st, they have to be called standards.
That's correct. It's a statutory change.
It's a statutory thing to call them standards, but they originally called guidelines. They're written like guidelines, and I think the expectation is that these are guidelines, not set in stone type of requirements.
That's exactly right. Plus, just like you all do for special use permits, coming before the HPC in a quasi-judicial hearing for a COA, it's discretionary. There are two types of decisions that occur for municipal decision-making boards. Legislative, which is text amendments and things like that, and discretionary, which sometimes includes subdivisions, but more often it's not. It certainly includes special use permits and COAs. And discretionary means that you've got the deciding-making board has some review criteria and some guidelines, which I agree is a better word than standards, in front of them, and they apply that to what is being brought before them. So it's not black and white where you check off, they've got the right window, they got the right paint. It's a question of HPC sitting up there and saying, yeah, just like special use permits, yes, this is consistent and harmonious, or no, it's not. You get into some, let's see, Mandy, I'm on page 6 now, too. We have some specific standards for new and renovated commercial buildings and additions. Greg, if you want to take any of these, that's fine, because you kind of grabbed them.
The original was one that I put together. We probably took out half the things that were in there. But a lot of this is actually cut and paste from other, like the Raleigh Historic District, which tend to be very broad in terms of guidelines. And these have certainly been much more modified versus what was originally presented maybe to the HPC 3 months ago. For example, E at the very top right there, I believe the HPC wanted that in there, and I agree with that, to give assurance to the property owners that this is just dealing with the exterior. So determining COA applications, the use of the property, and the interior arrangements of the subject building will not be considered.
And then under 4.2A, new and renovated, this is the main guideline. New and renovated commercial buildings and structures shall be designed with a scale consistent and harmonious with the B1 neighborhood. shall utilize details and elements as set forth therein.
So what does that mean, consistent and harmonious with the scale? If an application comes for 35 feet for a commercial building, is that allowed or not?
Scale,
it's not consistent with the scale. There's nothing 35 feet down there now.
There are 35-foot buildings within the B1 district. I think they're residential. There are some residentials that are 35.
Right.
And I think there's some hotels.
So I'm just thinking of K Avenue. Sorry. But
scale of size. Again, it is a matter of interpretation. And I preface this discussion with the idea that when you have guidelines that are fairly short and with wording like what we have, it is going to require a matter of interpretation. And I think that's one reason why the makeup of the HPC in the future is very important. Because it is a matter of just trying to define in words, try to capture the idea that what you want in there is things that are harmonious with what Curie Beach wants in the downtown area and with what is currently in the downtown area or in the B1 district. And so you're trying to write, and hopefully you appreciate the difficulty of trying to write something that is trying to capture something that you really can't put your finger on. Exactly. I mean, if we could pin our finger on it, because we started off with the idea of, has anybody else defined what a 1940 to 1970s architecture looks like? And, Google 1940, we looked at architectural reviews, we talked to the architect that we contracted to help us with this, and nobody could actually find a description exactly what a 1940s and 1970s. We know kind of what it looks like. We know what we don't want to have in the district. But even trying to write it in a positive way becomes very, very difficult. So what we've done here in terms of guidelines is provide wording, I think, and we have gone through this many, many times, wording that provides the HPC and the decision makers at least with some guidelines as well as the applicants so they can look at this and figure out whether a modernistic type thing would be consistent or not, that they can come to a decision in terms of issuing the COA. So it's not trying to be restrictive, although we are trying to restrict certain things from not happening within the downtown area.
And I don't think we wanted, as the project progressed forward, I don't think we wanted to define exactly what was required to establish a 40s to 70s aesthetic value, because that would be telling people what they could and could not do. But if you look at the rest of the standards, rather than me reading to you, 4.2 specific standards for new renovated commercial buildings and additions, 4.3 standards for new residential buildings and structures, 4.4 standards for additions to buildings and structures, it's all the same thing. They shall be permitted, provided they're consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood and designed so that the overall character of the property site, including trees and significant views of the district, are maintained. Again, I refer you to the special use process. It's hard to talk about these things in the abstract without a proposal in front of you. So I always think of the glass house in the B1 district and HPC considering whether that's consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood. I don't think it's any different than the function you perform on special use permits. And again, hard to give illustrations without definite projects in front of us.
Well, so I just say, just like in C, you said you can do anything you want inside your building. In A, I think consistent with scale says that, okay, you may limit height, and I don't know that I think that's reasonable. The 35-foot building height across the town, every property owner can go to 35 feet. And I don't think a board should say this is not consistent because you're going to 35 feet. I'm not saying they would or would not, but the way that's written, they could easily do that. That's out of scale. You can't go to 35
feet. That was certainly never the intention. I don't think anybody ever considered restricting anybody from going over 35.
We're not on the board.
Are you suggesting a revision, something along the lines, provided that no application will be denied, provided that 35-foot height established by the session law, yada, yada, yada.
Exactly right. Yes. Similar exemption to the board, to the future board, right? Because we're not the future board.
But this being a quasi-judicial process, that wouldn't be very prudent on our board's part to disallow somebody because we wouldn't have the information or the facts to back us up on that.
I can certainly find some place to cover both commercial and residential that basically says 35 feet's okay wherever for whoever. I mean, I can't.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just one, my point. Similarly, in E, at least for K Avenue and Atlantic Avenue, so I guess that's the boundary of the fire district, they have to be commercial. So in C above, you say that the interior and the use are not considered, but then in E, you limit it. It has to be commercial for the first floor.
Well, if I can jump into that, if you look at E under 4.2,
yes, sir.
We have a mixed-use overlay right on K Avenue right now. This basically extends the mixed-use. Now, the thing that we were interested in, and when you actually look at some of the consulting reports that were done in the last 10 years where people will have these ideas about what the downtown should look like, you know, they're all mixed-use. You know, they show a commercial on the bottom and some sort of a residential on top. What we're doing is we're emphasizing that because right now, just in this district, everything is commercial down there. So they would have to stay commercial.
Yeah, you're requiring it. Yeah. So our mixed-use overlay allows it. It doesn't require it. This requires it.
But this is a commercial, or this is a business district where the overlay is now our residential districts.
Right.
Okay, so the residential district on the overlay, what we're allowing them is to have a commercial activity on the first floor, even though it's a residential district. This is a business district where they have to stay commercial or business.
Yeah. They don't have to right now.
Yes, they do. If they're a commercial building.
The B1 allows them, it could be a single family residence in the B1 if they wanted to. If someone bought the property.
I'll ask John, Mr. Bass on that.
B1 residential is legally non-conforming, so you can't create a new residential use.
You can't create a new residential use out of something that's already commercial.
Okay, so it can never be bought and turned to residential. Okay.
Unless it's already residential.
Okay, that fixes the issue.
The building right beside Ocean Brook Park is an example of that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You know, the duplex built right there on Atlantic Avenue beside the front park was a residential in the B1.
Right.
And they rebuilt, they tore down, rebuilt, and put a duplex.
Right.
But the empty lots, because they've never been residential, can never be residential.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And it's been like that since the ordinances were passed in the 70s or 80s.
Right.
73. Okay.
What he was trying to do, understanding what the current regulations are, because if somebody wants to come in there, let's say take down one of the one-story buildings,
right,
say right there in the downtown area, when you look at the specificity of it has to be business, does that mean all three floors has to be business?
So you're expanding.
So we're actually expanding and say, okay, that the first floor has to be business, but in fact you could have residential on the second and third floor.
Right.
That's what we're trying to do.
I understand. Okay. So then that's an expansion. I didn't understand it that way. So
you could have condominiums on the second floor.
No, that expands.
Right.
That's a good thing. I didn't understand it that way. So thank you for clearing it up.
Let me catch up with you on a couple points. And John, I would like to ask you a few questions.
Yes, sir.
Jack Max, when they built the upper deck, that was just by permit. Would there be special problems with that upper deck in this process?
If you were to build that upper deck?
Yes.
Yes, it would have to get a certificate of appropriateness from the HBC.
I didn't catch all of that, John.
Yes, they would have to appear before the Historic Preservation Committee to get a certificate of appropriateness.
Okay. I don't necessarily believe that there would be a requirement for different materials or a different look than he originally put up there, but just a question. Then my next question would be, and again, I'm thinking of Big Daddy's. When Big Daddy's moved to their outside bar and their outside eating district, they would have needed to come forward and get permission to do that. Now, would we be approving the type of tables, the design of the bar, What are we approving when they bring that plan forward?
I mean, generally speaking, there are guidelines to tell you what you're approving, but it's also open to interpretation how much you can approve. I don't think it would be tables and chairs by any means, but colors and materials for sure. Yeah,
well, we wouldn't want chrome and glass tables out there.
They're going to bring you a project design, and you're going to look at it and say, that fits or it doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to tell them what kind of tables and chairs and materials and siding they're going to use. They're going to make those determinations themselves, and they're going to bring it to you and say, take a look at it. Do you think it's consistent with B1 or not? It's not that you're going to tell them, take the chrome off of that, use this particular siding, put that particular window in. That's not how these things work.
These things
simply give you a context for you to look at a proposed change to an exterior feature and say, yeah, that fits in the neighborhood. I don't have a problem with that. No, it doesn't fit in the neighborhood. But you're not going to tell them what color, what fabric, what siding, what table, what chair. We don't micromanage that. We don't macromanage that. It's just whether what they bring you doesn't fit.
Okay. The reason I asked those questions was to determine how some of these material definitions would apply in some of those conditions. You're essentially saying that as long as it looks comfortable with everything else, it's okay.
Absolutely.
That is exactly the objective here. It's just that we have to write them in as guidelines, but that's exactly, we can have a conversation and say what we're trying to achieve. Just, are you harmonious? Are you consistent with the look of the downtown?
Yeah, I was just
that's
trying.
That's what we struggled with for 6 months in terms of
trying
to get that into black and white.
Right, I was just trying to test the rigidity of those statements.
And I think Mr. Babs is absolutely right. Both of those examples, the Jack Mackerels and the Big Daddies, would come before the HPC for COA. Personally, if I was on the HPC at that particular time, I would say, of course they're harmonious. I don't see anything non-harmonious with what was done in either one of those cases. So that would be a fairly quick rubber stamp for COA at that.
Okay. Okay.
This
is a good discussion.
I'm sorry?
It's a good discussion.
The last standard would be on the last page again. And again, this comes directly from Mr. Bastion. We eliminated two or three paragraphs after in the original version. COA applications for relocation, demolition, or destruction shall not be denied. So that completes my discussion on the design standards. We can, TCC and council can discuss those matters, or we can quickly go through the text amendments and you all can discuss those. How do you want to proceed?
Can you just cover how that changed so much? Just in two sentences? Because that's fairly significantly different from what was in there, and I'm interested.
Well, the statute allows, the first version was drawn up verbatim from the statute. The statute allows for HPC to, if you got something that you think is significant and you want to save it, and somebody comes in and wants to relocate or tear it down, the authorizing statute allows HPC to, COA has to be, cannot be denied, that's in the statute as well. But the statute allows for HPC to make the effective date year out in order to explore options. Couldn't think of too many situations that might pertain to that in this town, so we just made it what it is.
I like it. No, I appreciate it.
Where this would be applied is, again, think of downtown Wilmington, where you might have a historic building. Somebody wants to demolish it and put up something else. Mm-hmm. It gives the statute as it's written, not the way we've written it, but the statute as written would give a year for somebody to come in and pick that up and move it, which is actually how several of those areas, commercial areas, mm-hmm. on Water Street, actually was developed by the movement of actually building it into that.
Okay.
So based upon Mr. Bass's suggestion, we said, no, we're not going to have that year-long window right there. If somebody wants to knock it down, you know, they can do it.
Mandy, how many folks are on the phone? Two? Okay. I would like to recess for about a five-minute comfort break, if that's okay with everybody else. Do we need a
make
motion?
Make a motion, we take a five-minute recess.
Second. 5 minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you,
Mr. Burke. Yeah, it's probably a good idea for all of us.
All right, you old man.
Yeah.
Hey, sorry.
Oh. Get the hip rolling. Oh.
Drink water.
You got it, Tommy.
Come on, hit. Thank you. Come on, hit.
That's
what I did wrong last time. Record? We hit record?
Motion to return.
So move.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Sure, before we get started on the text amendment, just as a preface to that, is that one of the things that the HBC was concerned about in our last meeting is to make sure that we do give a degree of confidence to the property owners that we're not restricting a number of different things. So you'll find that as we walk through the text amendment, you'll find other language that references design guidelines, but also is written in such a way to give confidence and security to the property owners that we're not trying to go overboard, if you will. So, with that preface, if it's okay, maybe we can kind of go through the text amendment language right now.
Okay.
Okay. Mandy's got it up there.
Page 11.
The first one is just the policy goals, and that basically piggybacks the statute authorizing the establishment of the historic district. B is the establishment of, I mentioned earlier that the text amendments to Chapter 15 have to establish, and D takes care of that. In the C, in the event that there's conflict between the underlying B1 regulations and the historic district regulations, the historic district will control.
So can you give me an example of that? So I understand the silent part, but when it conflicts, that's the part I don't understand.
I guess the only example, I'm not good at thinking of examples in a vacuum, but I guess the only one I can think of is B1, for example, B1 district doesn't regulate the appearance of exterior features. The HOD does. So if somebody wants to make a change to the exterior feature, they have to come in under the HOD regulations, not the B1 regulations.
Right, that's silent. I agree. I was asking about conflict.
I think an example, what we were talking about was that subcategory E, where the B1 district right now says the building has to be commercial. Well, does that really apply to the second and third floor?
But
where you have the overlay district of the historic district, where it allows them to have commercial on the bottom floor, but then residential on the second and third floors. So that would then dominate based upon that statement.
I would also add that the design standards are so flexible, I don't see any conflict.
Yeah, I really can't see a lot of conflicts here.
Just one question. So I'm looking at B1 district, at least what's on our webpage, John and Craig, and it says, dwelling constructed in conjunction with permitted uses above, the integral part of the main building. And then it says S, so it needs a special use, I guess. So right now, I thought when we talked about it, we could expand it, but it looks like they already could do that if they came to you. At least that's what our website says.
Expand what?
It says, the way I understood it is the HOD expanded it so you could have a residence in the second or third floor in the B1 district. But if I read the B1 district as posted, legend of district permitted uses, says dwelling constructed in conjunction with permitted uses above if integral part of the main building. And then it has an S, which I guess it requires a special use permit. Am I reading that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So then if they came to you right now, today, and said, I want to knock down Bud and Joe's and I want to put a three-story structure there commercial on the bottom floor and residential on the top two floors, that would be acceptable. Except they would have a parking issue, I guess, but they'd have to work the parking part out too, right? Is that true or not? Just so I understand.
For K Avenue between Atlantic and Fort Fisher?
Yeah, B1 Business District, that's what I'm reading.
Well, according to the HOD design guidelines, they can't have anything but business between Atlantic and K. So I would say they could come to HPC, but it's probably going to be denied.
No, I'm talking about right now. We haven't passed this yet, so right now, I'm reading
yes.
what's... Right now, they could do that right now.
Yes.
And the way you wrote E, they could still do that.
Well, I'm not quite sure. It would require a special use permit. Give your example, if you knock down a one-story building, you put up a three-story building.
Right.
Because it was, let's assume it was a commercial business.
Yeah, Bud and Joe's.
Okay, so they have to do commercial business. They would have to get a special use permit to do something, to put commercial and maybe do residential.
Right.
Special use permit could be denied.
Okay.
Okay. It could be denied by the town council, which would look at that special use permit. In this,
in the HOD,
if you look at this particular statement, they would be allowed to do that without the denial of possibility of a special use permit.
Okay.
Okay. Good. Good point.
D just mentions that B1 uses are preserved. Nothing about the HOD regulations affects the by right or special use. Uses that are currently allowed in B1. The design standards, we've already talked about that. At the bottom, certificate of appropriateness, there's no need to be redundant, we've talked about that. F2 at the bottom of page one, you get the COA before the building permit. The building permit has to be in conformity with what the COA provides. Turning the page, minor work we've already talked about. The definition is supplied in paragraph one. I've circled in paragraph three that 30 calendar day business about when, I think that's when HPC would hear the appeal. We can certainly shorten that if that's the consensus.
Why don't you just make that like 5 days? Because really, they already know what the decision is.
Well, I don't know if the board meets fast enough. That's the issue, right?
I would say 10 days. That gives flexibility if needed.
Okay. We can make a note on this.
Yeah, I would say 10 days would be reasonable instead of 30 days. You know, that the board would have to be within 10
there
days.
There may be circumstances that five too short for 10 cases.
Well, I think the bigger heartburn for me is the 30 calendar days after the hearing for making a decision. I mean, that's what makes it 2 months.
That's providing the copy of the decision, not making the decision.
The decision would be made during the hearing.
Bless you.
The decision happens during the hearing.
Yes.
Then it has to be reduced to writing and delivered, and that's where the 30 days comes in. We can shorten that.
So then the decision is at the hearing?
Yes.
Okay. They don't get to say we're going to go off and wander around and think about it.
No.
Well, I'm just asking, right?
Can we do that sometimes?
So, yeah. Well, we do it all the time. That's
yeah,
what I'm
we
asking.
Do it all the
That's
time.
That's right. We did it Monday night.
Well, I don't mean it maliciously, but
no,
the issue is,
yeah.
You know.
No, but we can certainly stick a sentence in there that says that the decision has to be made during the HPC
hearing. Right. So
and
then the person
then
knows if they can
be,
fix their property or not.
You know, and then it has to be given in writing within 10 days.
Doesn't it already say that the appeal shall be considered and acted upon at that meeting? Doesn't that mean
does
the decision
that?
Will be made?
Yeah, it says acted upon. So that would imply that it has to be the decision. That's a good point.
All the 30 days was about is just the written.
We can change that to 10. That's not a problem.
Okay.
H, we've already talked about the application. I, the building inspector shall review each application. Building inspector may determine, based upon his review of the application, that the proposed work constitutes minor work and may approve the same without having to go to HPC. Most of these are right out of the statute, so these text amendments didn't get revised. They only change some of these. J, hearings and notice. HPC shall follow quasi-judicial proceedings. Next page. I'm on page. I didn't number my page.
Page 13.
Yeah, where she's.
I'm there.
Again, right out of the statute, paragraph 2 are the notice requirements. Paragraph 3 are the notice requirements, again, pursuant to statute. 4 and 5, 6, 7, and 8 are all right out of the statute, so they can't be tinkered with.
Hmm.
HPC decision. HPC shall consider the application at its next regular meeting following the deadline. Use the review, paragraph 2, use the review criteria set forth, we'll see in a second, in subsection L of these text amendments. Like any quasi-judicial proceeding, paragraph 3, I'm on the next page, HPC shall make written findings of fact supporting the decision, and that's true for BOA, and that's true for you all on special use permits. I think the statute says, and I totally disagree with this, HPC shall make its decision within a reasonable time, and I put preferably during the meeting. The statute stopped within a reasonable time, but I've counseled a lot of municipal clients on quasi-judicial proceedings, and if you really want to adhere to the applicant's due process rights, you really need to have that decision made at the time of the hearing in open session. So I'd like to go ahead and just, like we did a little bit earlier, we just talked about, considered and acted on at that meeting.
I agree.
If I could jump in, this is really good. We've looked at this many times, but the conversation raises, you know, issues as we look at this too. One of the issues is what would the application look like? Because one of the things we don't want to do is burden an applicant with spending a lot of money putting together designs and architectural review and design guidelines and stuff like that, and spend thousands of dollars with an architect coming here and have it denied. So, well, we want to make sure, and it's not clear in here yet, but you know, it's something that we can work on. We want to make sure that there would be an application that would not, you know, with pictures and kind of a level of design that doesn't require massive investments of capital to get approval of the process before they spend $5,000 on an architect to be able to design something. So
the text amendments provide as follows. They don't require that kind of rigorous application, but in 8, subsection H, each application shall include sketches, drawings, photographs, specifications, descriptions, and or other material describing the proposed work and how it complies with the design standards. So we've left it very open.
Okay.
And again, that's the applicant's burden to come in before the board and show that they comply. So we don't need to tell them how they need to show that, but that is their burden to show that. I think, let's go on down to L, if we can get most of L on there, through 4. These are the review criteria. They kind of go hand in hand with design standards, so let's walk through those. Paragraph 1 under L, regulations and the design standards are intended to, insofar as reasonable, that's a key phrase, insofar as reasonable, ensure that the exterior features of buildings and structures within the historic district or B1 district, whatever you want to call it, shall be consistent and harmonious with the other buildings and structures in the HSD which contribute to the district's unique character. However, it is not the intent of these regulations or of the design standards to require the reconstruction or restoration of any buildings or structures, prohibit their demolition or removal, or impose any architectural style. So that's one of those provisions that gives some comfort to the property owner. 2, in determining COA applications,
Historic Preservation Commission shall consider the historic and/or architectural significance of the building or structure under consideration, the exterior form and appearance of the proposed changes thereto, and the effect those changes would have upon the other buildings and structures within the HOD. You can parse this language, but if you look at the code regarding your responsibilities under special use permits, you'll find almost identical language. So I don't know that it's a useful exercise to question what the text here means when you have similar text that you apply with looking at special use permits. Three, another reassurance. HPC shall make no requirement except to prevent exterior features which are not consistent or harmonious with the neighborhood. Shall make no requirement except to prevent exterior features from not being consistent or harmonious. I might have said that wrong. The only function is to ensure consistency and harmony with the neighborhood. Four, applicants consult their design standards. Five, HDC shall base its COA decisions on the design standards and the following criteria. The height of the building or structure.
So, can you tell me what that would mean?
I can jump on that one. You'd like to see that one out.
Well, I don't think we should limit a property owner's ability to maximize his property. Your email specifically said that the current height limitation is more limiting to development in the business district than any of these standards.
I don't think there's any disagreement that 35-foot height is permissible within the district. I think we've already agreed on that.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, the very first criteria you put in consideration is the height of the building.
No, that's before we had this meeting.
Okay. No, I just pointed out again.
That makes a very good point. I don't see a purpose for it.
Yeah, I marked it out before we even started discussing it.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay.
Setbacks, lot coverage, yards, orientation, positioning of the building and structure. Again, you've got the underlying requirements that still have to be met. Consider materials, surface textures, patterns, architectural details, roof shapes, fenestration, which I've never completely understood, but I think it's the layout of the doors. General form and proportions of the buildings and structures and pertinent features, including walls. And I don't think, we need to keep H in there because exterior features extends to signage, utilities. The exterior features by statute is very broadly defined, so including walls and fences, but I think we can take lighting out because we've already regulated that.
Can we change fenestration to whatever it really means?
I don't know what it means.
I know, neither do I. That's why I don't want it in our code, right? I mean, I want a citizen to be able to read it. I mean, I was going to Google it, but then I realized I don't even want to.
Well, we can take out that word.
Yeah, and use whatever. I mean, it's defined. I think I'm fine with what you're trying to say, right? You don't want some geographic wacky thing on the exterior. I get it, but I don't know what fenestration means. I could Google it, I guess.
Okay, I'll check that word out. M, interior arrangements not considered. N is what we looked at the end of the design standards, the COAs for relocation, demolition, destruction not to be denied. Nothing in these regulations or the design standards shall be construed to prevent the ordinary maintenance or repair of any exterior feature that does not involve a change in design, material, or appearance, nor does it prevent the construction, reconstruction, alteration, restoration, yada, 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 of any exterior feature that the building inspector shall determine in writing with regard to public safety. So if there's not going to be a change to the exterior feature, these regulations don't apply in the building. Point one, point two, separate point, building inspector can still do what the building inspector has to do. The
respect to unsafe or dangerous conditions. Nothing in these regulations or standards shall be construed to prevent a property owner from making any use of this property that is not prohibited by any other law. P, if you get a denied application, you can't bring it back in unless there's been a substantial change in the proposed work. Appeals, that's strictly out of the statute, time-wise. And last of approval, all COAs shall expire 1 year from the date of issuance. If there's been no progress, HBC can grant a 1 year extension. Failure to comply with the COA shall constitute a violation of Chapter 15 and be enforceable with the Chapter 15 remedies, which is a civil penalty. Discontinuance of work, lack of substantial process shall be considered as a failure to comply. And that's it. While these learned bodies discuss, I'm going to sit down and rest a minute.
Okay, in the way this is written, I think it's better than the first time I read it. I would have a question for you. Is there anything in here that says I can't build a 1968 McDonald's?
I'll answer that question. You can build a McDonald's, but you just have to, if you're going to put the gold, the question. There's nothing in any of this that says yes or no.
Right.
You really okay. got to get that type of thinking out of your head.
Right.
That's not how these things work.
So the...
If you come in with a picture of a 1968 McDonald's.
Yep.
And I'm assuming, I remember though, I was around then.
Yep.
Golden arches, whatever you want.
Right.
Chrome trim, whatever you want to...
Yep.
However you want to draw that picture. They'll bring that picture to the HBC, and HBC, in its discretion, will determine whether it fits or not. But I don't know that we can sit here today and speculate and project
right.
what HBC's decision will be, mainly because I don't have a picture of that in front of me.
I just Googled it. We would not approve it. It's got golden arches in it.
The golden arches probably would not be approved because
they wouldn't match the sign ordinance. But if you make adjustments for the ordinances,
and the drive-through wouldn't be approved either.
Okay. Yeah, so, the drive-through would be the hard part.
But let me point out that there are McDonald's and there are Jack in the Boxes and a number of different franchises
right.
in communities that have these type of regulations.
That's right.
And you can have them; it just has to be architecturally.
That's right. The outside uses that's different.
Okay, so they're really. Okay, beyond the regular zoning restrictions, there are no restrictions to the business.
Correct.
And beyond the intent of the look and feel of the B1 district, there are no restrictions.
Correct. I think that pretty well summarizes it. Yeah.
Right?
The use of these are regulated by code under zoning as well as a special use permit process.
True.
You'll be having something coming to you probably next meeting regarding special use permit because we've had to change the language because of a couple of court cases in terms of allowable businesses and that sort of thing. So there'll be more special use permit possibilities.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't concern ourselves today. Your conclusions are correct.
Right. But this doesn't regulate the use other than what's regulated by code and or the special use permit process. It simply is looking at architectural design to make sure it's harmonious with the B1 district.
Okay.
And Craig, you were asking about 1968 McDonald's, which does have the arches. And we actually do have it in here. Colors on exterior portions. For example, there shall not be any patterned color design such as those often associated with franchise operations. So
okay.
That would be enough.
And we originally had some pictures to illustrate this, and that could also be put in this document to have pictures of what we're talking about. But like Checkers, for example, Checkers, their whole exterior design is a checkerboard.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't be allowed. because it doesn't fit. You know, Checkers could have an operation here. There's nothing that restricts the use of a hamburger place or whatever. It just has to be Harmonies.
Okay. There any other questions for the work that's been done by P&Z or the counselor? I think it's been a pretty good session. Any view thoughts?
It is a joint work session, so if you've got concerns or issues that we theoretically PCC is going to take these text amendments up during the next meeting. I guess the next meeting. I have to think about that. That's next week. But take them up soon and get them to you all soon. So if you have some concerns or issues or suggested revisions, it'd be great to hear them now so that we can address those before they come back in front of PCC.
I think the process too. The design guidelines or standards are under the purview of the HPC.
Mm-hmm.
The text amendment at this point is under the purview of P&Z. Now we're one and the same,
mm-hmm.
but technically it'll come forward to town council with recommendations from the P&Z for the text amendment and recommendations from the HPC for the design guidelines.
Let me correct one thing. HPC by statute is the one that publishes the design standards. So if you all want something in there, let us know so we can get it in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
The PNC will come to you after the text amendment.
I guess the only thing that I heard in the discussions was taking a look at the time required, and I think there was some discussion on how to do that. And the only other item was, and you've already made sure that the height requirement isn't an issue. But beyond that, I didn't hear anything that required any other significant change.
You got the critical one. You got to get rid of fenestration.
Yeah. So, one, I appreciate all the hard work. Right. I know a lot of people have done a lot of work in this year. So, if you felt my questions were adversarial, I apologize if they came across that way, but I wanted to understand, right? Because I still don't know exactly where I am. If we go back to the beginning of this, the initial concern that prompted the 5-0 vote, at least one of the 5-0 vote, was we would not want a McDonald's on the corner of K Avenue. That was what was brought up, right? And I think I agree with that, right? I don't 100% agree with it because I'm a property rights libertarian, but I think I do. So, and then that's morphed to a lot bigger issue, which you explained very well, both Craig and the town attorney, about the fact that North Carolina, in I guess a libertarian bent, doesn't allow you to regulate the external portion of property.
That change came in when the Tea Party had ascendancy.
Exactly right. Right. So I'm not with them on a lot of stuff, but letting people do what they want on their property, I typically am with them on. So
let's let shipping containers back. Yeah.
So I said sometimes.
There's limits on your libertarianism, right?
Yeah, there are. There's limits on everything, right? I don't think I'm totally a white job yet.
Not yet.
I'm working on it. But, and thank you, Jeff. But, so one, I appreciate the work very much, right? And I do appreciate that this is a work in progress, so I understand that. So, like Craig said, the big issues for me as this first hearing, and I'm going to ponder everything I heard today so I can kind of go back through and read, and I'll send you an email, Craig and town attorney, for anything else I find. But really, fenestration was minor, but I like us to write stuff that people can understand. The 35-foot thing, I think should be in there clearly that you can't stop someone from going maximizing the height of their property because that's taking significant value away from them, right? Regulating the external part, to me, I think that's problematic, but it doesn't take significant value from their property, right? You have a lot of options, especially I like that you generalized it instead of having 50 pages, right? So, you know, there still is. They come to the board, and the board may have an issue. And then just the timeliness of action, which we talked about, right? To me, those are big issues because if someone wants to work on their property, they want to do it then, just like me and you. And if the government can slow that down for whatever process, more than it already is slowed down, that's a problem, right? So I appreciate all of it.
Can I make a comment about that, Jeff, too? What kept on getting past me on that issue when somebody comes for the administrative approval, and then, let's say somebody wants to put up half of their roof, you know, to match the other half that's already there, and they come to John, and for some reason John says, no, he can't approve it. That administrative approval can't go through. That's when they appeal, that's when they have to wait all that time, that's when all that happens. And I think that we've done a pretty good job of making it pretty simple, I hope, for John to be able to say, yes, you're changing your caulking, yeah, go ahead. You know, that, like, I don't see a good chance that there are going to be things that John's not going to approve.
Is there... Yeah.
For that minor work.
Well, so...
Minor work is just, like, changing out siding to match what's already there, things like that.
I understand. I said these are the issues I'm concerned with, right? Yeah. So
I just wanted to make that... I just wanted to just... It made me feel better when I fully understood that.
Yeah.
That timeline was associated with an appeal for something that John would deny.
Do we need to put in here what the board, the quasi-judicial board looks like?
No. We're going to cover that in the chapter 160D.
That I like the recommendations that Craig made on that, but that's not addressed, at least at this point.
That was the discussion right when we started this process. Mm-hmm. It was clear that the P&Z was going to be made mm-hmm. the HPC to bring us to this particular point. There was no expectation that the HPC format or makeup would look the same in the future. Yeah. But let me kind of just summarize the difficulty, and I think everybody here understands the trying to walk that fine line of trying mm-hmm. to make sure that everybody's happy. I mean, we have different perspectives about development and rights and that sort of thing. Yeah. But we're all in Kerry Bridge. We all want Kerry Beach to be better. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an underlying assumption that we're all here well. Because we think that mm-hmm. you know, we want to make Kerry Beach better. So, you know, it is this fine line type of thing. Mm-hmm. But also, ultimately, from my experience of having done this in many, many different states, is that ultimately the decisions are made by people. Mm-hmm. And you can have all the design guidelines and rules and regulations you want, but to have a good set of people making the decisions, mm-hmm. you're not going to have weird decisions. You're not going to have people blocking the attempts of people to develop the property. You know, I think people are going to be very, very reasonable. And my experience at Kerry Beach, of having, again, served on many different commissions and town councils in other cities, is that Kerry Beach has an astoundingly good set of people, all with a similar interest in terms of trying to keep things as nice as possible for mm-hmm. the community of Kerry Beach. So, you know, I mean, it's a people thing as well as a regulation thing, mm-hmm. ultimately what makes a big
sense.
Yeah,
I agree.
I agree with you, Craig. I think we have great people. But I listen to some of my friends in homeowners associations, and they have significant issues with their homeowner boards. So those are great people on all the boards. I've worked with many of them. But there are individuals in their HOAs that have pretty significant issues with their HOA board and how they are interpreting the rules of their HOA. And they signed up for that. When they bought their property, I assume they did. They're smart people. They read the restrictions on their property. This is different. The person that, or the people that own these properties, they didn't sign up for any of these.
And the interesting thing about an HOA, because I live in an HOA, and I've had to deal with HOA type of processing myself, mm-hmm. I've got other properties in HOAs too, is that what's interesting is an HOA will typically have 50 or 60 pages of regulations too. So, you know, it's the interpretation and the enforcement of those regulations. Where in our case, where we have basically 2 pages of design guidelines, not 50 pages, it really is made up of the interpretation and the decisions of the makeup of people on the HPC ultimately.
And although the decisions are significant and affect property rights, a COA decision is no less and no more than a BOA decision on a variance or a council decision on a special use permit. And certainly, since this house applicant doesn't know his likely result, but to me, it seems to have functioned pretty well through the years. This is no different. This is just adding one more tool to the toolbox.
I agree. I didn't say it was illegal what we're proposing. I didn't say that at all.
No, and
I didn't say I'm for or against it because I haven't decided, but I just want to understand.
Well, on your question. One thing I did forget to mention, HPC decisions on COAs are appealed, if they're appealed, to the DOA. So there's still that internal, still got one more bite at the apple.
Well, I have a tendency to sometimes oversimplify things, but I think that the work that was done here is very, very good work. And I'm kind of taken away from this that HOAs are peculiarly right rigid. You'll use wood here, you'll do this. This is not getting to that particular level. Essentially, this is saying, we don't want to interfere with what you're doing, but we want to say, does it look okay?
Here's what we're doing.
We want
to make sure that what you do is consistent with those six or seven excerpts from the land use plan back in 2006 where the public told you, we want to preserve the small town friendly, family-friendly atmosphere. One of the things that Chapter 160D does is when you decide a text amendment, if it's inconsistent with the comprehensive plan, by statute, that decision that you make that's inconsistent with the LUP automatically amends the LUP. This is a brand new development under Chapter 160D. So, if you've got all those LUP goals about preserving the small town, family-friendly atmosphere, and you reject this approach, which is the only way to regulate its preservation, you are, in effect, potentially changing those goals from the LUP and taking them out. Something to consider.
Can I also, come back to the HOA thing, too, because I can see the analogy that you're trying to make there. From my experience in HOAs, 100% of the problems that a homeowner might have in an HOA have to do with very, very, what could be considered minor type of things, such as the air conditioner not located in the right place, or they have a statue in front of their property, they have two American flags versus one American flag, that sort of thing. Where if you have an HOA, I've yet to see from my experience of being in an HOA for probably 50 years of my life, in different HOAs, nobody would bring into an HOA design of a whole building that would be completely out of sync with the HOA. That's not where the HOA conflicts are. They're with the kind of small, little things that people complain about. We're taking just the opposite approach here. We're looking at the big picture where if somebody looks at this, they know not to bring a certain design, let's say, because they know it's not going to fit in that design guidelines. But whether they have a table in front or something like that, we're not addressing that kind of issue. So it's a really different, even though it's a regulatory process on design, it's a very, very different fundamental philosophical perspective versus an HOA type of perspective. And I just don't see those types of conflicts from my experience. Okay. I know that Commissioner Elk had a question.
Craig, you kicked off the meeting talking about dropping the word historic. I agree with that personally. When you do the next rewrite, is it going to have that aspect, no more historic, if the preservation over the...
I would recommend that. In fact, Mr. Eldridge and I had a bit of a debate, a discussion on that. And I suggested we put the word preservation in it. We kind of agreed on historic and preservation. Obviously, without being up to HPC, I personally wouldn't have a problem taking out the word historic. By the way, there are historic districts in the state of North Carolina that do not have the word historic.
Here's what I would suggest. I think we have a consensus. I want to keep, by statute, we need to keep calling the board the Historic Preservation Commission. But why, about we change the name of the district to the Kira Beach Downtown Preservation District and take out Andy and Port?
Yeah, that's fine.
The word historic really creates a lot of problems.
It does. It brings a whole lot of other things with it, so.
I mean, Kathy brought that up as just kind of, so I wanted to emphasize it again. I like that.
Okay, so what schedule are we looking at? You're bringing something to us?
I think in terms of our timeline, we have a February HPC meeting and February P&Z meeting. And based upon the comments here, and I think Mr. Elder's been taking notes.
The agenda packet for those meetings next week is Friday or Monday.
Right, so there's a good chance that we'll vote and have a motion to push this forward to the town council. Okay. In terms of the text amendment. Because it's a Chapter 15 text amendment, you will have to schedule a public hearing on that.
Yep.
So there'll be a public hearing, and then if it goes, then you would then after that. So
okay.
I'm guessing, based upon this conversation, this workshop, that you'll probably have something forwarded to you with a recommendation by the P&Z for your February meeting.
Okay.
Did it pass 2.5 weeks? There you go.
Okay.
I don't think the changes have been, I think we've dealt with most of the changes that were recommended.
So, Mr. Eldridge, do we let P&Z adjourn first? Is that how that works now?
Sure, since you all are primary.
So, I guess.
Our meeting is on the 15th, so today's the 28th.
That's why I told him 2.5 weeks.
Well, PCC will act on these text amendments next Wednesday.
Okay.
In February, when they come to you, it's just going to be to fix the meeting, the date for the
public hearing, right?
Okay. So your question was, do they adjourn now before we do?
Right, that was the question. He said yes.
I need to adjourn.
Okay. Second.
You're going to
say aye?
Aye.
And we will have a new P&Z and historic district member next month, starting right now.
Mr. Okay.
Oh, Mandy.
So,
Mandy, hold her hand up.
I mean, this was just a joint work session.
Yeah.
Council's the primary governing board, and it's my opinion that council adjourns the meeting.
Well, yeah.
Oh, we are going to adjourn, but they have a meeting as well, so we left them adjourn first. They opened a meeting of their own.
They didn't have a separate meeting. They're in a meeting.
In any case, may I have a motion?
So move.
Second.
All right.
Yeah,
that was a good discussion. Thank you. Thank you all for the work.
Sorry, I wasn't on your meeting before.